Welcome to a deep dive into a really intense period, 1918 to 1921 in Ireland.
Okay.
So the sources you shared covered a time when the push for Irish independence really shifted, from the ballot box to the battlefield. Like, how crazy is that?
Yeah.
And we're going to look at how a political party went from having no seats in parliament to winning a landslide election in just a few years.
Right.
The surprising role that a prison in Wales played in that change.
Hmm.
And also how, everyday people found the power to actually challenge an empire.
Yeah.
So to help us kind of unpack all of this, we have an expert in Irish history with us.
It's great to be here.
Okay, so our sources start with Ireland right after the 1916 Easter Rising. And, things weren't exactly peaceful then, were they?
No, not at all.
The Irish Parliamentary Party, the IPP, the longtime people advocating for home rule, they were really struggling at this point. Mm-hmm. What happened?
Well, the IPP, led by John Redmond, had really believed in working within the British system.
Yeah.
They'd been pushing for home rule for decades. But after the 1916 Rising and then the execution of the leaders, there was just this huge surge in support for complete independence, not just home rule. People felt like the IPP was too moderate, too willing to compromise. Plus, there were all these continued delays in actually granting home rule, even after it was promised. So people started to lose faith in the IPP's ability to get things done.
And then there was that whole thing with Redmond and Lloyd George, right? Like a secret deal that kind of went wrong.
Yeah, the Lloyd George affair was a major blow to Redmond and the IPP. So Lloyd George, who was a British minister at the time, proposed this deal. Home rule, but with six counties of Ulster excluded. It'd stay under British control. Redmond thought it was only temporary, so he agreed to it. But then Lloyd George turned around and told the Ulster Unionist leader, Edward Carson, that the partition would be permanent. Can you believe that? Redmond felt completely betrayed and backed out of the deal, but the damage was already done. It looked like he was willing to compromise on Irish unity, and people just lost trust in his leadership.
Yeah, talk about political maneuvering. And then, as if that wasn't enough, the British tried to discredit Sinn Féin with that whole so-called German plot. What was that all about?
Oh, the German plot was just this clumsy attempt by the British to link Sinn Féin with Germany during World War I. They were trying to paint Sinn Féin as traitors, hoping to turn public opinion against them.
Yeah.
But instead of backfiring, it actually had the opposite effect. It boosted Sinn Féin's popularity.
Really?
A lot of Irish people already distrusted British propaganda, and this just looked like another attempt to manipulate them.
It's amazing how, sometimes when people try to control the narrative, it can just completely backfire.
Exactly.
So while the IPP was kind of falling apart, Sinn Féin, this group that had once been on the fringes, was gaining a lot of momentum. What do you think was the key to their transformation?
Oh. Well, I think a few things came together. First, their policy of abstentionism, refusing to take seats in the British Parliament. That really resonated with the growing sense of Irish nationalism. People were tired of empty promises and they wanted to see some real action. Second, the British government's response to the 1916 Rising, all the arrests and the internment of suspected rebels. It really just further radicalized Irish politics.
And this brings us to a rather unexpected turning point, Frongo Prison in Wales. So how did a prison become a catalyst for the Irish Revolution?
That's the fascinating part, isn't it? You see, after the Easter Rising, a lot of those who were arrested ended up in Frongoch. But instead of crushing their spirit being imprisoned together, actually brought future leaders like Michael Collins closer. It gave them a chance to really strategize and solidify their commitment to an independent Ireland.
So it wasn't just a prison. It was a breeding ground for the revolution.
Exactly. Frongoch was a university of republicanism. You had all these men from all over Ireland with different backgrounds and experiences thrown together. They debated shared ideas and really started to forge a shared vision for the future. For someone like Collins, who was such a brilliant organizer and strategist, it was an invaluable opportunity.
It's incredible how sometimes oppression can backfire and create these really unexpected consequences. And even within Frongoch, there were different visions for how to achieve independence, right?
Oh, absolutely. Collins was a pragmatist. He believed in guerrilla warfare. He understood that a small, agile force could really disrupt a much larger one. And that ended up being a key strategy during the War of Independence. But others, like Cathal Brugha, favored a more traditional approach, more open confrontation with the British. These different approaches would really shape the course of the fight for independence.
So we've got this really interesting mix of political turmoil and a growing sense of national identity. What happens next?
Well, 1918 brought a watershed moment, a general election. And that's where things get really interesting.
Okay, let's dive into that right after this. So we were talking about that 1918 election right before the break. What happened?
Well, the 1918 election was, a landslide victory for Sinn Féin. They just capitalized on the growing discontent with British rule and ran on this platform of complete independence. It was a total rejection of the old order, you know, a clear mandate for change.
Yeah, that must have been like a shock to the British establishment.
Oh, it definitely sent shockwaves through Westminster. Sinn Féin, sticking to their policy of abstentionism, they refused to take their seats in the British Parliament. Instead, they assembled in Dublin and declared the establishment of Dáil Éireann an independent Irish Parliament. It was a direct challenge to British authority, and it really set the stage for the Irish War of Independence.
So they basically said, we're doing this our own way now. And they didn't just stop at declarations, did they? The sources mentioned this idea of like a parallel government. What was that all about?
It was a bold move, for sure, driven by necessity. The Dáil, under leaders like Arthur Griffith and Michael Collins, they started establishing ministries to manage key aspects of this emerging Irish state. They had their own courts. A counter-propaganda unit led by people like Desmond Fitzgerald and Erskine Childers, even local government structures all operating alongside the existing British administration.
Wow, so they were basically building a new Ireland right under the noses of the British. How did they manage to pull that off?
Well, it was a delicate balancing act. It relied heavily on the support and participation of ordinary people. Collins, as Minister of Finance, launched the Dáil Loan. It was this remarkably successful fundraising campaign that tapped into the Irish diaspora, particularly Irish Americans, to get financial support. And this money was crucial for funding the independence movement.
It's amazing how they were able to mobilize all these resources and create this sense of a functioning government, even while under British rule. What was the British response to all of this?
I think the British were caught off guard by how quickly and effectively Sinn Féin was acting. They tried to suppress the Dáil, outlawed it, arrested its members. But the movement had already taken root. The parallel government, despite constantly being under threat, provided essential services, demonstrated Sinn Féin's competence, and further eroded British control.
So this brings us to the outbreak of the Irish War of Independence. Our sources point to the Solo Headbag ambush in 1919 as the spark that ignited the conflict.
The Solo Headbag ambush was definitely a pivotal moment. This group of IRA volunteers acting without authorization ambushed a police convoy that was transporting explosives. It was a really daring act of defiance, but it wasn't actually sanctioned by the Dáil or even the IRA leadership.
Oh, so it was more of a spontaneous act of rebellion than like a calculated move?
Yeah, and that's what makes it so interesting. The ambush wasn't part of some grand strategy. It was a local initiative, but it had this huge ripple effect. It pushed the country into open conflict, and it forced the British to recognize how serious the situation was. They responded with force, of course, deployed more troops, enacted harsher measures, which in turn just fueled the cycle of violence.
And the War of Independence wasn't a typical war, was it?
No, it was a very different kind of conflict. It wasn't a conventional war with armies clashing on battlefields. It was a guerrilla war fought by these small mobile units of the IRA. Using ambushes, raids, and sabotage to disrupt British control, this decentralized approach made it really difficult for the British to effectively counter them.
Yeah, the sources mentioned that the IRA, despite being like vastly outnumbered and outgunned, managed to gain control of large parts of the countryside. How did they do that?
Well, the IRA's success can be attributed to a few factors. Their knowledge of the local terrain gave them a real tactical advantage. They used hit-and-run tactics, melted back into the civilian population after attacks, made it really hard for the British to track them down. Plus, they had the support of the local population, who provided shelter, intelligence, and supplies.
And then there was Michael Collins's intelligence network. The sources paint him as this brilliant strategist, almost like a spy master.
Collins was a master of intelligence and espionage. There's no doubt about that. He created this network of informants within the British administration, including the Dublin Metropolitan Police, which gave him really valuable insight into British movements and plans. This intelligence allowed the IRA to anticipate British actions and strike effectively.
The sources also mentioned the Squad, this special unit within the IRA that carried out targeted assassinations of British agents and informants.
The Squad was a highly secretive and controversial unit. They operated in the shadows, targeting key figures within the British intelligence apparatus. Their actions were brutal and often sparked outrage, but they were undeniably effective in disrupting British operations and instilling fear.
Yeah, one of their most daring operations was the elimination of Alan Bell, a British intelligence officer who was close to uncovering the Dáil's secret funds.
Bell posed a serious threat to the independence movement. He was a skilled investigator and was getting really close to finding the financial mechanisms that kept the IRA and the Dale going. His elimination was a risky move, but it was calculated, and it protected vital resources and allowed the movement to continue operating.
It sounds like the War of Independence was characterized by all these daring actions and bold strategies, but it wasn't just about military tactics, was it? There was a human cost to this conflict.
Oh, absolutely. As the conflict escalated, both sides resorted to increasingly brutal tactics. The British, frustrated by the IRA's elusiveness, deployed paramilitary forces like the Black and Tans and the Auxiliaries, who became notorious for their reprisals against civilians.
Yeah, we see this reflected in the sources with incidents like the burning of Cork City in 1920.
The burning of Cork City was a devastating act of retaliation by the Black and Tans. It left much of the city center in ruins and caused widespread outrage both in Ireland and internationally. It's a stark reminder of the brutal nature of the conflict and the heavy price paid by civilians.
And there are also the poignant stories of individuals like Tomás McCurtain and Terence McSwiney, both Lord Mayors of Cork, who were targeted and killed by the British.
Their deaths were significant turning points. They were seen as martyrs for the cause. It further fueled Irish resistance and galvanizing international sympathy. McSwiney's hunger strike in Brixton Prison, which ultimately led to his death, captured the world's attention and highlighted the brutality of British rule.
And then there's Bloody Sunday, a day that would be forever etched in Irish history.
Bloody Sunday in November 1920 was a horrific event. British forces, seeking to disrupt the IRA's intelligence network, opened fire on civilians attending a Gaelic football match in Croke Park. They killed 14 people and injured dozens more. It was a shocking act of violence, and it further inflamed tensions and eroded any remaining public support for the British presence in Ireland.
But amidst all this violence, the IRA continued to fight, demonstrating their tactical prowess with victories like the Kilmichael ambush.
The Kilmichael ambush, just weeks after Bloody Sunday, was a significant victory for the IRA. They inflicted heavy casualties on a British auxiliary patrol, demonstrating their growing military capability. It also highlighted the effectiveness of their guerrilla tactics and their ability to outmaneuver British forces.
So we see this escalating cycle of violence and retaliation. But even as the conflict raged on, there were moves towards a political solution. The British government, realizing that a military victory was unlikely, introduced the Government of Ireland Act in 1920.
The Government of Ireland Act was an attempt to appease both sides. It proposed the partition of Ireland, creating two separate parliaments, one for Northern Ireland, which would remain part of the United Kingdom, and one for Southern Ireland, which would be granted limited self-governance within the British Empire.
But this wasn't the outcome Sinn Féin had fought for, was it?
No, it wasn't. Sinn Féin rejected the partition plan. They saw it as a betrayal of their goal of a united and independent Ireland. They refused to recognize the Southern Parliament and continued to push for a complete break from British rule. The irony is, Sinn Féin then went on to win all but four seats in the Southern Parliament. It was a resounding rejection of the British plan.
So despite the violence and the political maneuvering, Sinn Féin remained the dominant force, pushing for a completely different future for Ireland. What happened next?
Well, faced with a stalemate and mounting pressure both domestically and internationally, the British government offered a truce in July 1921. This paved the way for negotiations between Sinn Féin and the British government, a delicate process that would determine the fate of Ireland.
It sounds like we're on the verge of a pivotal moment in Irish history, one that will shape the future of the nation. Let's explore that right after this. Okay, so we left off with that truce in July 1921, right?
Right.
Setting the stage for these negotiations between Sinn Féin and the British government. So what were the main things they were trying to figure out in these talks?
Well, the stakes were incredibly high. Sinn Féin, led by Éamon de Valera, wanted a fully independent Irish Republic, completely free from British control.
Right.
But the British, they were only willing to offer dominion status, kind of like what Canada and Australia had at the time.
Okay.
Which meant that Ireland would still be part of the British Empire, just with, you know, some degree of self-governance.
So basically, a huge difference in what each side considered acceptable.
Yeah.
How did they even begin to try and find some common ground there?
It was a really, really tense and complex process. De Valera, you know, known for his uncompromising stance, he didn't actually attend the negotiations in London himself.
Really?
Instead, he sent a delegation led by Arthur Griffith and Michael Collins.
That's interesting. Did the sources give any insights into why De Valera decided to stay back?
Yeah, there's been a lot of debate about that among historians. Some believe that De Valera, with his strong Republican principles, He wanted to avoid being directly involved in any compromises that might be necessary to reach an agreement.
Yeah.
Others speculate that he wanted to maintain a bit of separation, given the option to reject any deal that fell short of a republic.
Yeah, that's kind of a clever move, isn't it? He could distance himself from any unpopular concessions,
right,
but still have the final say.
Exactly. It allowed him to be more strategic, observe the negotiations from a distance, and retain the authority to either endorse or reject any agreement.
Okay, so tell me a bit about these negotiations. What were some of the key sticking points?
Well, one of the most contentious issues was the oath of allegiance to the British monarch that Irish MPs would be required to take. This was a major stumbling block for the Irish delegation. They saw it as a symbol of British sovereignty. There was also the issue of partition, you know, with the six counties of Ulster remaining part of the United Kingdom. While Sinn Féin was completely opposed to partition, they knew they might have to accept it as a temporary measure.
It must have been so challenging trying to balance their ideals with, the reality of the situation. Did the sources talk about how the Irish delegation dealt with these really tough choices?
Yeah, from what we can tell, there were tensions and disagreements within the delegation itself.
Mm.
Griffith and Collins, recognizing the need for compromise, were more willing to accept certain concessions to get a deal, while others, remained firm in their demands for a republic.
Wow, so much happening behind the scenes.
Right.
With the future of a nation at stake.
Absolutely.
What was the final outcome of these negotiations?
After months of intense back and forth, the Irish delegation signed the Anglo-Irish Treaty in December 1921. It granted Ireland dominion status within the British Commonwealth, similar to Canada. It also included provisions for the establishment of a free state government and the withdrawal of British troops from most of Ireland.
So not the full republic they had fought for, but still a big step towards independence.
Hmm.
How did people in Ireland react to the treaty?
It was really divisive. It actually led to a split within Sinn Féin and ultimately a civil war.
Oh, wow.
Those who supported the treaty, like Griffith and Collins, argued it was the best they could get. In a stepping stone to full independence, those who opposed it, led by De Valera, saw it as a betrayal and a continuation of British influence.
It's a reminder that even in moments of victory, there can be these deep divisions and lasting consequences. We've covered a lot in this deep dive. From the decline of the Home Rule movement to the rise of Sinn Féin, the War of Independence, and those really difficult treaty negotiations, what are the main things you think our listeners should take away from all of this?
I think the biggest takeaway is that the fight for Irish independence wasn't straightforward at all. It wasn't just about political freedom, but also about figuring out what it meant to be Irish and creating a new sense of nationhood. It was a time of huge change, with moments of heroism and tragedy, idealism and pragmatism. And it's a story that still shapes Ireland today.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. It's been an amazing journey through such a pivotal time in Irish history, filled with all these fascinating people and difficult choices. And we hope this deep dive has given you a better understanding of this complex, fascinating period in Irish history. We encourage you to keep exploring, dig deeper into the sources and come to your own conclusions about what it all means for Ireland both then and now.